Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. And we are looking at what it takes to get an edge in your career, in your profession, how to get the get a leg up on your competition, if you will. And joining us now is Khalid Sifri, the Chief Executive Officer of Emirates Investment Bank, a very sexy industry that many people are keen to get into, whether it's investment banking or private equity. But let's hear a little bit more about Khalid's background.
Khalid Sifri is the CEO of Emirates Investment Bank, a private bank with investment banking advisory services headquartered in Dubai. In a career spanning over 30 years, Khalid brings extensive international banking and legal experience, holding senior executive positions as well as serving on the boards of directors of several businesses in the Middle East and globally. Prior to joining Emirates Investment Bank, Khalid held senior positions with Shua Capital, a regional investment banking firm. As Chief Corporate Officer, Khalid was responsible for the company's proprietary investments, managing a portfolio composed of marketable securities, private equity investments throughout the Middle East, and strategic investments in the financial services sector. Prior to that, Khalid acted as the head of Shua's investment banking group, where he was responsible for the corporate finance, capital markets, and research departments. He led the team that provides access to the capital markets of the UAE by way of initial public offerings for companies such as Arabtech, Salama, Air Arabia, and Aramex. Over the years, Khalid has developed great passion for the preservation of the Arab culture through encouraging investment in education and the arts. In his capacity as CEO of Emirates Investment Bank, Khalid has helped to sustain and preserve regional art through the development of the bank's private collection, which comprises of artworks from celebrated Arab and Emirati artists, as well as avant-garde works by younger Arab artists. In a personal capacity and stemming from his roots, Khalid is an avid supporter and former member of the Board of Trustees of the Welfare Association, a foundation dedicated to the education, cultural preservation, and community development of the Palestinian people.
Well, Khalid, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Hi.
It's quite a bio. So you've done one or two things in your day. So it's a real pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So did you always know you wanted to be an investment banker? Were you, I think there's a lot of people out there who just dream of it from a young age. What was the genesis of your journey?
When I was young, it wasn't necessarily as sexy as you make it sound right now. But nonetheless, that's not my objective from the beginning. Initially, I sought to be a lawyer, and I went to university in the U.S., studied law, and actually practiced law for a while before eventually finding my way to banking.
So law is one of those professions that's almost industry agnostic. It's almost like George, who was on before, is an accountant. These are professions that can weave their way through various industries. And it almost looks like when you look back in hindsight that those individuals who get a professional qualification like accountancy or a legal qualification have an edge.
These are capabilities that are invariably needed in every business proposition. So anything that touches on business will require, to some extent or the other, some sort of accounting or financial know-how, as well as legal know-how. Without an understanding of one or the other of these concepts, or the concepts involved in these sort of professions, it probably makes it difficult for people to succeed in business in any case. So even those who don't study accounting and don't study law and succeed in business must have, in one way or the other, learned the skills arising from legal and accounting professions.
So it's almost like if you were hell bent on being a successful entrepreneur or business person, the best would be to be become an accountant and a lawyer together. That's unstoppable. What they should do. If anyone young person's out there thinking, "What should I do?" This would be the best combination, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the question about the best is a difficult question to answer. I'm going to hedge those questions in that it is one path. I think it's a powerful path, and it can bring good results. But obviously, there are many people out there who are successful and arrive at their success through different paths as well.
So for you, you actually initially wanted to be the antithesis of the investment banker. You wanted to be a humanitarian lawyer.
Yes, in fact, my original target was to go into public international law, which would mean potentially a career in a place like the United Nations or things of that nature. Being a Palestinian, the issue of Palestine is something that we live with throughout our life because of the cause that exists and the importance of the international arena for that cause. So I had a bit of idealism in that I would have liked to participate in playing a role in that area.
But life had other plans for you.
Yes, unfortunately, yes.
So it's almost like the seeds of your greatest moments in life or your brightest moments are planted in your darkest. And so you suffered a huge loss, but is one that put you on the path you're on today.
Yes, that's right. I say unfortunately, it's because the change of my path occurred as a consequence of my father's passing rather suddenly, and my arriving at a situation where I was obliged to take on responsibilities that I wasn't planning on taking on at the time. And as a consequence of that event, my life path changed.
Your father passed away, and you were responsible for taking care of the family.
Yeah, that's in a nutshell.
What a tough moment that must be. At one hand, you're suffering with the depression and loss of your, you know, closest loved one, or one of your closest loved ones, and then at the same time, you're put on with the economic pressure and stress of supporting a family.
Yeah, and the support is not only support financial, but also, you know, being there and playing the role that is required to keep things going. My father used to play an important role, obviously, within our family unit, and there was a vacuum that I was attempting to fill to some extent in connection with my mother and my brothers. Most importantly, it led to a situation where I didn't have the freedom to go off and choose something that takes me away from them. So I had to persevere in the context of the legal profession in the private sense, in the business sense.
So you were pushed into the private sector.
Effectively, yes.
And so then what happens? But, you know, at this point, you're still a lawyer. You know, how do you make the jump into becoming an investment banker? And I think so many people want to know the answer to that.
Well, I mean, I joined the banking profession in 2004, leaving the legal profession at that time. That was the last time I was a lawyer. As a lawyer, I worked a lot with investment companies. I worked for corporate finance teams, helped them conduct transactions in the mergers and acquisitions space and in capital markets activity, and found that I was doing a lot of that work as a lawyer, and there were certain pieces that I needed to learn in order to understand the full context. Spent some time educating myself on those aspects, and then got the opportunity to lead an investment banking team at Choa Capital at the time, and made the jump then.
They just offered you the job, or?
No, I used to do a lot of work for them in the same.
So you were doing an M&A law?
Basically, yes. Corporate.
On the law side.
Yeah, that's
and you
right.
felt underpaid that you were basically doing all the work and the investment bankers were taking the fees.
Yeah, you can say that. I mean, lawyers, we would charge by the hour as a lawyer, usually. So you're sitting there counting the hours, and you probably do, you can in certain transactions end up doing a substantial proportion of the work. But the bankers sometimes, despite doing potentially a smaller part of the work, they may end up achieving a bigger financial reward.
I think we have to turn the air conditioning up over here. It's getting a little hot in the studio now. So, you know, the bankers might say the opposite, that the transaction wouldn't exist without them originating it.
Right? That's correct, and that's what I've learned. I mean, I was under the impression that the fact that I could do a lot of the actual work as a lawyer was sufficient to achieve success as a banker, as an investment banker in particular. I discovered very quickly on that that's not the whole thing. It's what's more important, obviously, is the origination of transactions, which is quite difficult to do, but also just as important is having the market awareness to be able to have a transaction conclude. So even though you may have all the legal pieces in place and all the accounting pieces and all the due diligence that is there, there are questions of pricing, there are questions of getting the deal done by having the two sides, if there are two, sometimes there are more, agreeing basic commercial terms, which was something a little bit outside the scope of the role I was playing as a lawyer.
So you jump into this role in Schwab Capital. Was there a culture shock, or was it you know, smooth sailing for you?
At the time, actually, it was very interesting, and it was pretty smooth because the team at Schwab was very collegial, and everybody worked well together. So the environment was very supportive. And I think if you strike a good tone and balance with the people you're working with as colleagues, it helps. It helps a lot.
This is Khaled Sifri, the Chief Executive Officer of Emirates Investment Bank. Khaled has over 30 years of experience, both on the corporate law side as well as the investment banking side of things. He's also held numerous board positions throughout his career, including Intrawest, a New York Stock Exchange listed real estate development company that was sold for over $2 billion. He's also previously on the board of CTO, a Canadian venture capital fund, and he's also been on the board of equipment leaders such as Forest Systems, Exelon, and Extreme Networks. And prior to joining EIB, Khaled was a senior, held several senior positions within Schwab Capital. We're going to hear more from him and his idea on how to drive peak performance in just a minute.
Dubai Eye 103.8. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. We're having a bit of a competition this evening to see who has the best definition of leadership. If you want to take a stab at the question, you can SMS us at 4001. That's 4001. Or use our mobile app to send in what you think your definition of leadership is. Here's one from Jones. He says, leadership can be defined as having the ability to influence others to follow you or to do what you ask them to do. Leadership is pushing yourself and your team off a cliff, then building a plane on your way down. That was anonymous, but a fairly brazen approach. Here's another one. Leadership is all about vision, motivation, direction, coordinating, coaching, mentoring, bringing the best out of your team and driving your organization to its top. That's Adiris Kasmani. If you have a definition, please send it to us at 4001. And it's an interactive show. So in fact, if you have a question for our guest, you can also SMS that in or use our mobile app to send any questions you may have into the show. And one of the other, you know, I think, which is a great thing, is the show also has a live component on the ground. So you can come and see us live on November 30th at the Canadian University of Dubai in the Red Theater. at 7 p.m. and we're going to be talking about peak performance. And to help lead that dialogue, we have some of the top CEOs and CFOs in the region. Ziad Makazumi, the chief executive officer of Faki IVF, one of the leading fertility clinics in the GCC. I think debatably the leading fertility clinic in the region. And Ziad was also the former CFO of Arabtech. Be talking about how to drive peak performance in your career and in your organization. He will be complemented by Mukhtar Hassan, who's the chief executive officer of Al Bareej International, one of the top private equity firms in Oman. Anas Sadek, who is the managing office partner for Deloitte in the Middle East, North African region. And Kashif Rana, who is the group chief financial officer for Aqua Power, one of the leading utility companies out here in the region. So these four senior gentlemen will be talking about how to drive peak performance in your career and in your organization. And that will be at the Canadian University of Dubai, November 30th. It's a Sunday evening from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. It's free. It's a free event. Everybody's welcome. And it's a community event. So generally, we have about 200 people attend these. They're quite good. Enough about that. We have in the studio with us one of the leading investment bankers in the region. He's a lawyer. He's got 30 years of business experience. And he's got so much stuff. I actually made a mistake on his bio, which we'll clean up in a minute. But Khaled, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
I think the last time I introduced you, Khaled, I said you were on the board of a few companies, which is not true. What it was the equipment leaders for Systems, XLAN, and Extreme Networks were actually companies you had invested in.
Actually, I was on the board of a venture capital fund that invested in these companies as well as others. Yeah. It's a bit of a stretch to be able to serve on the boards of these companies, actually, at the same time as everything else I was doing.
Right. But some people do it. You know, I think that's the best job is if you just have a onslaught of board positions, it's not too, it can be attractive.
That's an interesting retirement plan.
I think a lot of people strategize this for that. But when you look at it, I mean, you've done so much, you've worked across so many industries professionally. What's been your biggest challenge?
There, obviously, challenges are abound quite regularly on a day-to-day basis in running any kind of a business. But in my case, if I were to refer to a specific serious challenge, I would go back to the role I was playing in managing a manufacturing business for a few years in the U.S. This was a business that I found myself involved in as a consequence of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. At the time, I had left Kuwait and was looking to do something in the medium term as things settled in Kuwait. We have a family investment with some others in this manufacturing business. So I went there to review the business and see how it's performing, found myself eventually sucked into it and playing a management role there. The challenge came about a couple of years later when it started becoming clear that the business was not able to perform up to expectations, up to the original plans. And we've had to then take some serious decisions. So arriving at the accepting and concluding that one needs to change the strategy when a strategy is not working was staring me in the face at that time, and I had to do something serious about it. So had to do some tough things, including letting people go, a large number of people, changing the strategy for the company, and eventually handing it over in a different shape to someone else and then leaving it.
I mean, that's got to be one of the tough decisions when you stop throwing good money after bad. And so many, I think, companies get sucked into that they already have a high sunk cost that they want to keep investing to try to pull out of the nosedive. And I guess, was that one of the big lessons learned for you, that you need to be able to not be so emotionally attached to your asset that you willingly can pull that ejection cord when you need to?
Absolutely. I think it's essential that you need to try to maintain objectivity. The fact that you invest a lot of money and you have already put effort and attached part of yourself to it because it's a business that you're involved in establishing and growing and so on. So you start imagining, you can imagine, and I did for a short while until I figured out that I need to be careful how I was thinking, and I thought that the failure of the business would have been representing a failure of mine, and that it would reflect itself on my person. In fact, managing the process in a way that was transparent, that was clear to everybody who was involved, all stakeholders were being dealt with fairly, and you try your best to go through that process, but deal with it in a manner that is reflective of the reality of the situation and deals with the reality as opposed to some sort of fantasy, allows you then to move on with your integrity intact and go on and do something else.
It's funny that what you pull out of that is walking away with your integrity intact. And I mean, I almost think this is one of the defining features of those people, that your values have to be larger than your situation, that you're actually more loyal to your character than you are to the external situation.
Absolutely. I think especially for those of us who grew up in this region, the question of personal reputation is paramount. We come from relatively small societies, and one's reputation sticks with them for a very long time. And if you do things that take care and protect your reputation, they come back and help you in the future. If, on the other hand, you behave in a manner that may give you an opportunity to achieve some short-term success at the expense of giving up some values of yours or diminishing from your own personal integrity, it comes back to haunt later.
I always liked the phrase, I don't know, how you'd react to this, but the average performer is focused on what they can get, while the top performer is focused on who they can become. And the subtext of what you're saying to me when you're saying, I'm really focused on my integrity, I'm really focused on my reputation, your point on the horizon is who you're becoming as a person, not what you're actually getting out of the current situation.
I think that's part of how one views success as well. I mean, it's related to the question of success. I heard you on the show earlier, and the question of success arises in many conversations. The definition of success is different for different people. And in my view, true success is success that allows one to be true to oneself, notwithstanding what you achieve in the short term in terms of material gain.
Right, very, very, very interesting. Very interesting point. So, you go through this situation, and it's almost like at the time it's one of the worst things that happens to you. But when you look back on it, it's almost one of the most critical stepping stones to your success. That failure, in fact, is the stepping stone of success.
I agree with that. I think that's a true statement. Obviously, one does not need to have one disastrous failure after another to be successful. But I think it's important that one embrace a failure of various natures, those failures that they come across, and try to learn something from them, as opposed to bemoaning them and crying over spilt milk. You have to learn as much as possible from all these experiences, the ones that turn out to be successful as well as the ones that turn out to be failures. Without having the failures, one can find that in many instances there are experiences that are missing.
An interesting statistic from the American economy is that the average entrepreneur goes bankrupt 3.5 times in their career. Donald Trump, for example, has filed for corporate bankruptcy, not personal bankruptcy, but corporate bankruptcy four times. So far, you know, I'm sure he's not done yet, but he's a very wealthy guy. So, and I think, you know, you're almost grown up to think that, you know, when things are going well or you're doing the right thing, it should be effortless. But in reality, when you're really driving things forward, it's abrasive. It's uncomfortable. You're falling down, scraping your knees. There's blood on the floor. And those are the real marks of success.
I don't know where that statistic comes from, but 3.5 times is for successful people. Maybe it refers to the top 1% or something like that, because the average American, I'm sure, entrepreneur, average American entrepreneur would not have had a chance to have three or more bankruptcies. Only those who can afford, the only ones who can afford it are the ones who are at the top of the pyramid.
Who's your favorite entrepreneur out here?
Oh, there are lots, and I wouldn't want to make specific reference to any
individual. I would challenge you, though, to pick someone, and you will find, like, you know, look at Einstein. He was thrown out of every school. Thomas Edison, 10,000 failures before he got...
But not 10,000 bankruptcies.
Look at Steve Jobs, thrown out of his own company, fired from his own company. Bruce Henderson, founder of Boston Consulting Group, fired from every job he ever had, you know, and it just goes on and on. When you look at these guys who are creating huge success, they are covered in failure.
I agree that there are a variety of failure moments that people go through in order to get to a successful proposition. But that's because there's a lot of trial and error involved in any case. However, that doesn't mean that people need to actually go bankrupt three or more times before they can get successful. Bankruptcy, in my book at least, is not evidence of a normal failure that you repeat again and again. Bankruptcy means, to some extent or the other, you either found out that you can game the system sufficiently well that you can go in and out of it and still be successful. Bankruptcy is supposed to be a stigma that stays with you and then tells people that they shouldn't work with you. Because I tell you, if I get a client in the bank that has a previous bankruptcy up their belt, I'd be reluctant to do business with them.
And so this is the story of Khaled Sifri, the chief executive officer of Emirates Investment Bank, looking at what it takes to be successful. And coming up, we're going to look at the story of Buster Douglas, the first person to knock out Mike Tyson, and where he found his strength. And what does your darkness play into your light in just a minute?
Dubai Eye 103.8, keeping you up to date with what matters in the UAE. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are here with Khaled Sifri, the Chief Executive Officer for Emirates Investment Bank. Khaled, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
We were just really looking at this interesting paradox. On one hand, where you know, if I could summarize what you're saying, is success begets success. When you look at a company and they have a history of success, you're more comfortable doing business with them. If you see a company that's been speckled with bankruptcies and everything else, you're a little bit hesitant. And I would argue that, you know, the brighter the light, the darker the shadow, and sometimes people run away from their pain, their dark moments, not realizing that the seeds of your greatness are there. And I just closed that with saying that, you know, Buster Douglas was the first person to knock out Mike Tyson, but he was a nobody. And, you know, what had happened was just before the fight, his mother died. And his mother's, you know, was a big supporter, saying that he was going to beat Mike Tyson. And so it was his sense of purpose that drove him to relentlessly challenge Mike Tyson and take that championship. And then after that, Mike Tyson was finished. His last performance was biting off Evander Holyfield's ear, and we know the rest of the story. But that greatest moment was started with the darkest moment of his life. And I just think that sometimes people go through darkness and they don't realize that that's your God's gift to you. That moment, God's actually giving, those curses are your blessings. And I don't know if that means you're just looking at me like I'm crazy. And no. That could be true as well. Yeah.
No. I think it is true to a large extent that the way someone deals with those dark moments will determine very much how they will end up performing in the longer run. Now, there are a lot of anecdotes that one can come up with that deal with human behavior that is varied and quite complex. But when you come to deal with specific business issues, one needs to be a little bit more down to earth in addressing them. So when I say I would be reluctant to deal with someone who has had a significant business failure on their hands, doesn't mean that one would not deal with them full stop. It just means you have to be more careful. You have to understand where the failure came from. Did the failure come from some flaw in judgment? Did it come from some flaw in character or value system? Or did it come as a consequence of a change of external circumstances? Each one of these explanations and others may lead to a different conclusion. So if someone faces a situation of difficulty of that nature, which is explainable in a meaningful way, where they've learned something from it, of course, that means they may have a better chance at being more successful as a consequence of that event.
It's paradoxical in a sense that if you are a trailblazer, if you really are out of the box, then you will be rejected by the herd, right? Like Einstein was thrown out of school, like Soichiro Honda was not able to get a job at another, Toyota denied him a job thinking that his designs for the piston were no good. And the fact is that he's out of the box. He's bringing new ideas to the table that the competitors don't recognize. So you, if you are an outlier, if you are in that top 5 or 10%, it's almost like the whole system works against you and you can be consumed by it. You can be steamrolled by it.
You're opening a subject that can lead to a very deep conversation about Homo sapiens and the psychology of Homo sapiens in general. In my view, we inherit genetics that take us from millennia that allow a certain type of people to be in a position to naturally be inclined to deviate from the norms. This is absolutely necessary in any developing species as a consequence of such walking away or working themselves away from the norm allows them to evolve and do something different. If everybody was going to do the same thing throughout history, we would not be here today in the state of development that we are as human beings. People have to be able to test the limits, and representatives of a group of people of a certain part of society will always be ready to take those leaps of faith, to take those pushing the envelope to another extent. And many of these people out there who do that, you'll never hear of, because they crash and burn, and no one knows anything about them. But a certain proportion of them manage to actually achieve something as they push that envelope, as they take it to the next level. And those are the ones that we hear about.
I read an interesting quote. It said, you know, the reasonable, logical person tries to adjust themselves to their environment because they realize they can't change their environment. And the unreasonable, illogical person tries to change their environment to suit them. So all progress in society is based on the unreasonable person.
I think society needs both and others. It's not as simple as just one or the other. If everybody was in society an envelope pusher, I don't think that the human race would function either. So for the human race to operate, you need people who take those kinds of chances, a proportion of whom will make it and a lot of them who will not make it, but the rest of society survives.
But, you know, and under the theory that you're presenting, then it suggests that we put undue credence to leadership itself, and that, in fact, it's not the leader but the followers that are the most important, that if you really want to make change in this world, it's the first, second, or third follower to the leader that's actually making the difference. Because without those first three followers, the leader doesn't even exist. The leader is just an eccentric psychopath that's out there, as Dr. Jamil said, throwing himself off a waterfall. And so in essence, if you really want to make change in the world, be the first follower. Don't be the leader.
I think there's an argument to be made for that. But also sometimes a follower is important because without a follower, a leader will never arrive anywhere. So you need to have leaders to be successful, assuming they're not jumping off that cliff, really. Because, I mean, assuming that they're doing something that's pushing the envelope in a manner that has a chance of achieving something new and taking, you know, a business or a society towards a different direction that may be useful and successful, that would be useless if there isn't somebody following. And most people will follow only after they see that there is at least one or two more people out there ahead of them. The majority of the people would sit back and wait to see that it's not just what lone, you know, crazy guy up front, but also he does have at least one or two guys walking with him.
So you have to foster this consensus, and you have to drive people to rally around in an idea. And so I guess you have to drive this, especially in an investment banking private equity sense. When you're coming in buying a company, you're in fact changing the entire ethos, the collective subconscious of that group.
Nice segue, but I mean, there's a little bit of disconnect here as well, because when we're talking about the leaders of the type that are out there changing society or doing things those who change how we behave as a group and or change business in a very dramatic sense. Those kinds of leaders have, I believe, a different dynamic that they need to deal with. But if we're talking about the leader of an existing business activity that is reasonably well understood and a business activity that has a lot of stakeholders, you have a responsibility to protect the interests of all these stakeholders. So it means you're supposed to be leading in a manner that gives these stakeholders an opportunity to achieve their objectives. And in many cases, I dare say in most cases, it means don't jump off that cliff. Get people to follow you in a path that makes sense to them, that they can buy into, that they can see that it has a significant chance for achieving the objective sought.
So why is it you feel that many leaders fail to do what you were just articulating? What do you think some of the big reasons are for them falling short of the mark is?
I think a lot of it has to do with balance. A lot of it has to do with being able to find that relationship between the extremes that could lead to very high risk and could lead to causing adverse results for oneself and one's stakeholders, and the other extreme being too conservative and not willing to take any risks and hence falling short of the objective sought. I think striking the right balance between those two extremes will allow people to have the confidence to follow and fulfill the objectives that are being set out for the business.
This is Khaled Sifri, the Chief Executive Officer of Emirates Investment Bank. Coming up, he's going to be sharing his insights into what he looks for when he's hiring top investment banker, private equity professional. Best part about the show, it's interactive. So if you had a question for Khaled or for me, you can SMS us at 4001. And you can also join our competition if you have a good definition of what is leadership. You could win the prize. You can also SMS that in at 4001. Or you can use a mobile app to send your answer in to Ion Careers on Dubai i1038.com. And as well, we're also having a free live event on November 30th at the Canadian University of Dubai in the Red Theater, where we'll have Ziad Makazumi, Mukhtar Hassan, and Asadik Kassif Rana, some of the top CEOs and CFOs in the region, talking about how to drive peak performance in your life and in your career. So stay with us. Coming up, Khaled Sifri talks about what he looks for when he's hiring top performers.
Dubai Eye 103.8, award-winning news, business, sport, and lifestyle coverage. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are here with Khaled Sifri, the Chief Executive Officer of Emirates Investment Bank. Khaled has over 30 years of business experience, starting his life as a corporate M&A lawyer and then making the shift into investment banking. Before he joined Emirates Investment Bank, he was with Schwa Capital in a series of senior executive roles. He has been on the board of publicly listed companies. He has bought and sold companies. And he now is leading one of the, it's the, actually the only onshore investment bank in the country, I believe. Khaled, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
That is correct, right? You're the only investment bank with an onshore investment banking license.
No, actually, there are many banks who have such a license, but we are the have the capability to conduct investment banking activity, but we are the only bank that is licensed exclusively in that sector. So we are a private bank and an investment bank exclusively. We don't have retail banking. We don't have corporate banking. We just do banking for business people, entrepreneurs, high net worth individuals, and the like.
So what do you look for when you're hiring, to your top professionals or these investment bankers?
I mean, this is a pretty broad question, and it would have different answers under different circumstances. If we're talking about people at different levels and different businesses also, the point here is that most importantly, one needs to recognize what is required for the role, for the specific position, and make sure that the people you interview and those who would offer the position to would have a good fit in that position. So sometimes you may come across an individual who is extremely smart, extremely capable, very well educated, but he's not necessarily going to be a good fit for the position that is required, because when you run an organization, you need to deal with multiple skill sets, and you need specializations in different areas. And you can't get the somebody who is extremely good in a skill set and put them in a place which requires a different skill set, unless you're trying to change something within the organization. So fit of purpose in terms of experience, capability, from a pure technical, professional point of view, is number one.
And today, though, the rate of change is so fast that we're almost saying the only constant is change. Technical knowledge almost, could be potentially becoming irrelevant because it's changing so fast? And executives today, they need to be dynamic. The rate of change within the organization has to be faster than the rate of change in the market, or you become a dinosaur.
Agreed. The fact that you employ somebody, you look for people to employ who represent a good fit for the job, doesn't mean that they are automatically suitable for the job versus the competition for that job, just because they have some experience in that category of business or in that area of expertise that you require. Also, you have to look at beyond the professional into the personal capabilities as well, into the personality as well as the value systems of people, the way they respond to situations, how they will have a fit not only in the position but in the team as a whole, how they will be able to interact with their colleagues, how will they be able to communicate with people who report to them, and so on. So there are multiple other factors, not just the professional capability and the fit for the position professionally. But still, I say that's where you start. That's number one. You fit that position. You make sure that the people you shortlist have to have a good fit first. And once you have a shortlist of people who have a good fit for the position professionally, then you can have the luxury to try to figure out who would fit in culturally, who would fit in on a personality level and value system level.
And in your opinion, what are the top traits of the successful investment banker?
In the industry, there are variety of terminology used in describing two types general types of people who are successful in their own way in investment banking. There are people who are referred to at times as hunters and or rainmakers. These are people who are able to source deals. They're able to convince companies that they should do certain things. These are few and far in between. You can't find a lot of these people. It's just innate capability that allows them to be able to create and be very creative and innovative in how they deal with the potential clients and creating transactions out of them. But there's another category, which is very important as well, just like we were talking earlier about leaders and followers. You also have, in addition, you cannot have a successful investment banking team if you are all out there being hunters. You need some skinners. There should be some people who are going to be able to do the hard work.
Skinners? Is that what you said? Yeah. I haven't heard that before. Yeah. Is that like... like a scalper, or what is a skinner?
Yeah, I mean someone who actually gets their hand dirty and getting the details done and making sure that everything, all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, doing all of the due diligence that's required, creating all of the financial analysis that needs to be created, and doing a lot of the hard work that is absolutely necessary for success. So. There are a variety of traits, and you need to have that variety in the system in order to be successful, as a group, as a team. It's a lot of teamwork, by the way, in this business.
Do leaders have to be good followers as well in today's environment?
I mean, I heard that question before. I'm not sure I know the answer precisely, but I don't think it is a necessity that one needs to be good at following to be a good leader. I think good leaders are probably better at questioning authority than following.
What's the best strategy? We have the audience here sending in a few questions for you. What's the best strategy for, you know, once you identify a top performer, how do you keep them? So what's the strategy for keeping these high performance individuals, often very difficult to manage?
Yes, we have a lot of prima donnas in our industry, so keeping them happy is not always easy. But I think, obviously, the first answer anyone will give you when you ask this question is, you know, you have to remunerate well. Yeah, I mean, that goes without saying. The remuneration has to be reasonable. It has to allow these people to be paid in a manner that they feel they deserve, and that they actually deserve because they generate business for the company. But I think more importantly, it's not just about money. It's about relationships within the team. It's about being able to understand them and them understanding you, having a sense of loyalty to each other that develops with time, with trust, being able to engender that trust, being able to convince them that there is a certain amount of safety associated with the relationship that exists. So yes, for a lot of people, and it should be, money is important, and it's important, and it's something that one should not ignore. But I think there are many other cultural and collegial aspects that needs to be taken into account when you retain people and make sure that they stay and be happy what they're doing.
We are quickly running out of runway here and coming up to the end of the hour. What is your final piece of advice for anyone who wants to get one notch up in this game?
I think hard work, perseverance, honesty, sincerity. These are sort of the values that I believe in, and I think would be very helpful in making anyone succeed in any business or any endeavor or objective they want to do.
Hard work, perseverance, and honesty, integrity. I added the integrity, but I think that's what you were saying.
Yes.
But thank you so much, Khaled, for coming out and spending your time with us and giving some insight into what it takes to be successful in the sexy world of investment banking.
Thank you very much.
Hopefully we can have you on again soon sometime.
Inshallah.
That was Khaled Sifri, the Chief Executive Officer of Emirates Investment Bank. Khaled has over 30 years of business experience and is one of the top bankers in the region. That's it for this episode of Eye on Careers. Just want to remind you that we do have a live event on November 30th, in Sunday night at 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Canadian University of Dubai, called The Executive Mindset, Driving Peak Performance in Your Career and in Your Life. We have some of the top CEOs coming out and talking on a panel. So please come out and check that out. You can get it at meetup.com if you search The Executive Mindset. And I'm your host, Shane Phillips, saying make the rest of your life the best of your life, and good luck chasing your dreams.